Welcome to Bergenomics, demystifying economics with Ross McDowell.
In this final episode of the Bergenomics blockchain series, distinguished Professor Jason Potts and I talk about the practical implementation of cryptocurrency and why the financial establishment may feel threatened by crypto. Let's just deal with Australia then, because it would appear we've got a lot of vested interests against a cryptocurrency in Australia. You've got the Macquarie Bank chief executive coming out saying that the regulators can't protect consumers from unscrupulous parties. Yet there's an organisation that would be making a lot of fees and just declared a $2 billion profit. So I think that there's a grain of salt in maybe what they're saying. You've got our own central bank who would probably not wish to have a cryptocurrency because they will lose control, they feel, of monetary policy. We've got the government worried about tax avoidance, the government worried about their own fiscal policy and financing it, capital being shifted offshore, and also the exchange rate policy, again, would be affected, especially in Australia, seeing we export so many of our commodities. How do you see it playing out in Australia?
Yeah. So two things there. The first thing is, you know, for the last 100 years or so, we've all gotten used to the idea that there's one money, one country equals one money. There's no reason that that has to be true, and historically it hasn't been true. We've had, money is just another economic good. We use it for a savings technology, for a payments technology. We use it for a bunch of different things. And in a pure free market, in a pure free society, citizens and consumers will choose the money that works best for them, that provides safety or identity management, or has nice properties. It's easy to use, whatever. Right. So money is a technology, and you want citizens to choose the best technology. The situation we've had for the last 100 years or so is that by fiat, this is the money you will use. We don't use that for lots of other things. We don't have a sort of national biscuit where this is the biscuit you have to use and says the government and no other biscuits can exist. But we have this weird situation with money where we have a monopoly, and I use that in the economic technical sense. There's a monopoly on currency issue. So first of all, one way forward is that we enter into a world where there are just mini monies in Australia. Money providing or finance providing organizations compete to introduce the best sort of money, and the Australian Central Bank competes alongside them with the Australian dollar and goes, the Australian dollar is pretty good money. At some point you'll use it for paying taxes, but why not use it for these other things as well? And it just competes in that. So that sort of free banking world, which again describes the 19th, 18th, 17th, 16th centuries in most of the world. Like most of human history was that world. It's relatively recently that we've had sort of monopoly or fiat currencies that were legal tender because governments insisted that you use their money and not anyone else's money. So just to think about that, the exceptions to this that prove the rule is there are lots of small, especially city states or island nations that just use someone else's money. So lots of places in the world use the US dollar, even though they've technically got their own money. So we know about that. The other thing to note, and this is an important point, is that a cryptocurrency isn't just a money. It's a money and a payment system. It's the full rails that sit underneath it. So when I use the Bitcoin blockchain, when I pay you in Bitcoin, I'm paying you on with a money, Bitcoin, but I'm also paying you through the Bitcoin network. So a cryptocurrency isn't just a money on the surface. It's a money plus the entire validation and security and payments rails all the way down. Now, the Australian dollar isn't just the Australian dollar. It's the Australian dollar plus the interchange banking system, plus all of the sort of currency controls, plus all of this administrative infrastructure that we broadly call the payment system. The banks run the payment system. They are deeply invested, not just in the Australian dollar, but in the use of the Australian dollar on this particular payment system rails And you know that those rails end at the border. This is why currency transactions and moving money between countries is so hard, is that you have to interchange between two different payment systems. This is why Bitcoin is just magical for sending money overseas, because it's the same payment system. When I send money to someone in Australia, in New Zealand, or Guatemala, I'm not interacting with the Guatemalan payment system. It's just Bitcoin. It's the Bitcoin blockchain all the way. So dramatically lowers the cost of sending money. So in that sense, Bitcoin as a money is a really, really good international money, because it's one payment system. Does anyone using the Bitcoin protocol is on the payment system. The Australian dollar is a great payment system in Australia. The Australian dollar is a horrible thing to use in Fiji, because we have to interact with a different payment system. So again, these are just saying money is a technology. It's a very complex technology that's got multiple layers. And in the same way that mushrooms are not just the sort of fruiting bodies you see on the surface, but all the sort of deep layers of you know, rhizomes and stuff underneath. Government money or fiat money or isn't just the, you know, the notes and coins in your wallet or the digital account in your balance. It's all of the infrastructure and payments rails that sit underneath that. And that's what's being threatened here. And in a sense, when people are looking at cryptocurrencies and going, well, why do we need that? I don't get that. I can use my government money. Yes, you can. That's absolutely you can for some things. And for some things, it's really good for that. But there's a bunch of things it's not good for. With cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, if I pay a dollar, if I'm sending $1,000, if I'm sending $1 billion, it's the same. It's just, it doesn't cost me any different. I can send a $1 billion transaction to someone in France right now, and it'll be done in 10 minutes, and it'll cost me $1.20 in fees, maybe less. Try doing that with the money payment system. It's 3 days at least. There's no way you're sending $1 billion for less than a much larger fee. So there are costs. And again, you know, if you're sending $1 billion, maybe you want to absorb a bit more costs to ensure that works. But the money systems we currently have are pretty good. In some places, they're really good, but they're not perfect. And there is still room for technological improvement on some margins. And I think this is what cryptocurrencies are, is that they just open the space of technological improvement and innovation in money and payments for some things, right? It works broadly better for international. It works broadly better for anonymity. It works broadly better for some things. Now, again, not everyone benefits from that. The banks definitely don't, and some governments don't.
Let me ask you the question. How long do you think it will be before people will get confidence in using cryptocurrency, because the fluctuations, which are currently wild in cryptocurrency, no longer exist, that it becomes far more stable? So people, if they're doing a transaction over the course of 1, 2, or 3 days, they don't feel at risk of that Bitcoin or Minecoin dropping in value, and so it takes the risk out of the transaction. How long do you think we are before we can see that?
We're already there. We have been for a few years. So this, no one really pays in. If I want to send you some money, I'm not going to send you Bitcoin. We would have done that a few years ago. The reason I'm not going to do that now is I want to hold my Bitcoin. What I want to do is I want to send you some money in a stable currency. So I'll send you a stable coin instead. So I'll send you an Australian dollar stable coin or American dollar stable coin, whatever you want to be paid in. And that is stable with respect to the unit of account. So we don't have that problem anymore because we can use stable coins. Now, I've just described a technical solution, and we can definitely use that. It's not as easy as it should be. The interface to use that is hard. This doesn't interact with the banking system easily. Although, you know, here we are, 4th of November, I think it was yesterday, CommBank announced that they're now accepting they're now integrating with cryptocurrencies. So it should get better. But at the moment, it's a user interface and just consumer confidence issue. Technically, there is no fluctuation and volatility problems now. The value of the cryptocurrencies are fluctuating. But you don't have to use the cryptocurrencies for money and payments. You can use them as a store of value to send a stable money, a stable coin with that. Now, again, stable coins are new concepts. Very few people have experience with them. They've only really been around for a few years. So I think that, you know, we're at this very early stage of consumer and user adoption. And in that sense, you know, we look back at the internet and search engines and things like that, and just how could we live without them? But there was a period in the early 90s where they were pretty exotic. They were hard to use. Only a small number of people had used them. And it wasn't even clear what you used them for. They didn't seem to have a purpose. I think we're at that stage at the moment with stable coins as just digital money that is stable with respect to a Australian dollar or American dollar or New Zealand dollar. And I can hold money in a stable coin. Technically, it's a cryptocurrency, but I can use it exactly as I would use an Australian dollar.
We didn't actually define stable coins. It's a coin that is backed by another asset or currency.
Yep, it's such as Bitcoin. So how I create a stable coin is I have a token that is going to be collateralized. So if I'll drop some Bitcoin into a vault. That vault will collateralize this stable coin. And I'm then paying with the stable coin or using the stable coin as my unit of account. So it's a cryptocurrency. It still functions as a cryptocurrency, but it is stable with respect to some other unit of account. So most stable coins in the world are US dollar ones, just simply for historical reasons. The US dollar is a reserve currency that is used there. So, but there's different ways you can create a stable coin. It can be algorithmically stabilized with respect to derivative contracts or smart contracts, which is some sort of DeFi magic, decentralized finance magic, or it can be a straight up collateralized one where I could put another cryptocurrency such as Ethereum or Bitcoin into that. I'll over collateralize it so that I don't have to keep topping up the account. But it's basically a way of creating a cryptocurrency that works more like a money that you're familiar with and doesn't have the fluctuations and the over collateralization of it. You know, I might put, say, $2 worth of crypto of Bitcoin in to stabilize $1 worth of a stable coin.
Do you see stable coin as being the stepping stone to the Bitcoin type of mined currency?
Well, a stable coin is just a money that we can use for transaction purposes. Bitcoin is actually not really a money anymore. It's actually more of a savings technology. People use it as, it's more like digital gold rather than digital cash. So in the same way, I don't pay with gold bullion in my day-to-day life, but I could put gold bullion in a vault and then borrow against it in Australian dollars and then use those Australian dollars. So that gold bullion is collateralizing my loan. So again, it sounds complicated. It's like, why don't we just use the Australian dollar? And we can. But I think what stable coins compete with will be central bank digital currencies, which is essentially the government producing a pure digital currency that has all of these properties. Now, the problem with central bank digital currencies is that they're a surveillance money. The government can see exactly what you're spending with them. The benefit of a stable coin is it has anonymity and privacy. It's more like cash. So again, money is a technology. It has lots of different features. Some monies are traceable, some are anonymous, some are volatile, some are easy to use, some are costly to use, and so on. And you know, the whole sort of argument about why crypto is just that money should be like any other commodity. Let people decide what they want to use and let them sort on which margins. I don't see cryptocurrencies replacing government money. I see them, or vice versa. I just see just a richer ecology of money. And in the same way that, you know, we like that in every other industry, we like lots of choice of cars or bread or whatever. And we want technology and innovation to be continually supplying us with new things, and we'll choose among them. I think that's also true of finance. And so that's the optimistic view of what cryptocurrencies are doing. The pessimistic view is it's disrupting a technology, a monopoly technology that works pretty well in most situations, but could be improved and has, you know, has a bunch of vested interests associated with it that are perfectly happy with that. So depending on which side of the fence you're on there, us.
Now, distinguished Professor Jason Potts, we get to the end of our podcast where, after you having demystified blockchain, crypto, distributed ledger, I'm going to ask you to apply that immense knowledge that you have to our hamburger. So if we look at the hamburger in our society, the two pieces of bun, the beef patty, lettuce, cheese, you buy it from a retailer, it's made from cattle, agricultural growers supply it. It is our most simplistic analogy that I like to apply with all of my experts. Over to you.
Yes, thank you. I've been thinking hard about this one. So we're going to describe what I'm going to call the distributed hamburger. The way you described it just then, it's made of cattle and there's cheese and there's grains and so on. A hamburger, in terms of its ingredients, is naturally distributed. It's made of lots of different parts. And crucially, every one of those parts is owned by someone different. The cattle rancher is not the same person that's growing the lettuce. It's not the same person that's doing all the other components. What we do to make a hamburger is we then centralize it. We have a company that buys all of those components and then owns all of those components and assembles the hamburger in a centralized hamburger technology thing, right? And we do that because that's efficient, right? And we can't get the rancher to coordinate with the lettuce grower because that would just be costly and weird. And how we, you know, what chance have we ever got to get a hamburger? So what's happening with crypto, not just cryptocurrencies, but with blockchain technology, is it dramatically lowers the cost of using decentralized production technology. Now, we didn't talk about this in today's podcast, but maybe we'll come back and do it next time, is this concept of DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations, or just this ability to have the cheese owner own the cheese all the way in till it gets to you, the consumer, without having to sell the cheese to McDonald's or you know, whichever is the centralized firm that took ownership of all of those components and put them together to deliver it to you. We did that for economic efficiency reasons, but in principle, in theory, we don't need to do that. We could have complete decentralized hamburger where the hamburger that comes to you is owned by 27 different parties that supplied each of those things, and then hamburger token that you cash in. The tokenized hamburger then makes automatic payments that go all the way back to the cheese producer and the rancher and so on. And that sort of hamburger protocol that you, when I buy a hamburger, I buy a token that will give me the right to purchase a hamburger that executes all of these components to come together. That model of distributed manufacturing and production is what blockchain technology makes possible. Now, whether we will choose to use this for good or evil, whether we will use it to disrupt McDonald's, I think that would be a terrible thing. The way we make hamburgers is pretty good right now. But there's lots of things that we do make that we don't necessarily need to use companies buying everything and assembling them in a centralized place that we might want to make in a distributed way. An example of this is what we're doing right now. You and I are in different locations, in different places. We've never met before, but we're coming together to do a thing, to produce this podcast. That idea of podcast token, then going out and distributing the rents and rewards and status and whatever else we want to distribute with that. There's just lots of opportunities for distributed production that this technology can do. So the first thing that we thought of with blockchain was, we'll use that for our money. And that was pretty good because, you know, money was definitely a use case. But the thing I'm excited about is actually just global manufacturing and global production, that instead of having a whole series of different companies at different stages of a supply chain, where most of what they're doing is checking everyone else's work in order to produce things. We can have distributed production, where ownership of, I grow the beef, and I own it all the way through the supply chain. I didn't hand it off to you to put it into a thing. I own it all the way through, and I can verify it. I can now. We discussed this right at the beginning with this problem of the Ford XYGTs. That problem of, if I can prove that that bit of beef was mine, and I can trace it all the way through, so that you at the consumer can, that's that beef that came from Ross's farm. Now, whether that's molecular printing, I don't know how we do that. So there's still some technological problems we need to solve with that. Mm-hmm. But this idea of distributed production. And distributed production, where what blockchain is doing is providing the economic infrastructure to deal with ownership, identity, contracting, authentication, verification, licensing, just all of the just proving that something is true as information in order for it to move along. That's the promise, right? That's the promise of this distributed ledger technology. A lot of what we do, a lot of the way we organize our economy is around centralized ledgers. A company is a centralized ledger. It's a you gather all the ownership in one place and you put it in one place under one person or legal person, and you solve that problem because it's efficient to do it. That used to be true because we didn't have any alternatives. Now we do. We won't use it for everything. It's not a magical technology that will replace everything. There's lots of things that won't change at all. But for some things, on some margins, this idea of distributed production or distributed coordination, I'm really excited by it, because what it means is it naturally operates on a global scale. It doesn't operate on a national scale or a regional scale or a small scale. This is naturally as big as the internet. And the same thing, the thing about the internet was it was the first truly born global technology. It was wherever you could connect up phone lines and computers. That was where the internet was. It didn't naturally exist in America or naturally exist in Australia. It was wherever connected devices were. Blockchain, cryptocurrencies are the same thing, but just scaled up. So one way that this is, I'll end with this point. Blockchain is Web3. It's the third generation of the internet. The first generation of the internet was communication, sending messages, secure messages. The second generation of the internet was social. This was Facebook and Google and these large corporations that we used for putting commerce and value on the internet. We had to use big companies. The third generation of the internet is we distribute that again. And it's right there in the title. It's distributed ledger technology. And we're 13 years into this. We're still playing with it. It's still a wildly experimental, crazy technology that often breaks and is weird and has been abused by many people for scams and has been confused by everyone. We're very early still. But once we figure out what are the good uses of this, which I think we're really starting to get a handle on now. This is why I'm excited for the next decade of this. We will start to see some just really quite sort of dramatic improvements. Because fundamentally, what this technology is it's automation. It's automation of distributed trust. It just enables you and me to work together at much lower cost without us having to be in the same place or working for the same company or me having to check your ID and make sure who you are and so on. I can send you money. We can coordinate. We can just cooperate to create value together at a much larger scale. And the bottom line here is it's cheaper. It's just a cheaper way of doing something that was previously quite expensive. That's all we ever ask for from technology and innovation, is just enable us to do more things better or the same things cheaper. And that's what this is.
Professor Potts, that's a fantastic end to our podcast. You've done a great job in demystifying what most people don't understand. So thank you and congratulations on doing that.
Absolutely my pleasure, Ross.
I hope you enjoyed listening to Australia's preeminent expert on blockchain, distinguished Professor Jason Potts, the co-director of RMIT's Blockchain Innovation Hub. Jason makes blockchain, distributed ledgers, and cryptocurrencies far less threatening than what we read about in the mainstream media.